So I'd like to talk tonight about what truly matters. Regarding meditation and spiritual teachings, at the end of the sitting, at the end of the day, at the end of the retreat, at the end of your life, what truly matters is what worked for you. What worked for you, not for somebody else, even the person sitting right beside you, as much as you might kind of feel something coming your way, and by the way, that is happening in this room. This is one meditation that we're all sharing. Everyone's meditation, to some extent, is affecting everyone else's. And if you want to expand that, you could say anyone on the planet meditating, anywhere in the universe is meditating, is affecting all of us. So it's really interesting to see that in some way is a truth, not an idea, which means you sense it or you feel it in some way. And right there, to whatever extent that happens, even just a little bit, the sense of my meditation has been affected, hasn't it? It's been altered, it's been shifted. The perception of my meditation has joined a little bit of our meditation. I mentioned it in one of the small groups, I think it was yesterday. I really like this teaching. I don't quite remember how it came to me, but I like it very much. Somewhere in China, or in Chinese Buddhism, which is very layered and vast, there's a statement that says the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha, who walked the face of the earth about 2600 years ago, they say he's perfecting his enlightenment somewhere in the universe. Now, I like that. I like that. We're going to need to be really honest with ourselves. We can't fool ourselves. We're going to really have to be ruthless in our honesty if we want to see what really works for ourselves. We've got to be careful about this powerful thinking mind of ours and the way that it thinks it understands. And it really believes that it does. But how deep does that understanding in those thoughts go? How much does it really bring relief to what ails you? How much does it bring relief to what ails others? Because if you can figure out to reduce your angst or your ailments, then to the extent that you do that, to that extent, you can give that to others. That's literally how it works. So freeing yourself, so to speak, is how you truly help, if you're interested in helping, this world or others. It's the absolute opposite of that mind view that says, if you focus on yourself, if you meditate, like some people, you might know them, who would actually believe or judge this activity that you've been involved in here as selfish. You're doing what? And who's leading that thing? What? Oh, I get it. You're navel gazing. That's right. I think we're doing a little bit more than navel gazing. Any teacher or guide, whether that teacher or guide is in the body or not, because you don't need a teacher in the body. You don't even need a human teacher. The teachings, the teacher, can come in all kinds of forms. It can pop right up through the concrete in the form of a blade of grass. And when there's a receptivity to see, something is revealed there through that very scene. I once gave a talk many years ago, I can remember it a little bit, many years, maybe 16 years ago. And the talk was entitled, Insight Needs a Garden. And then I went on talking about what I thought the garden was. And as the years have rolled on, I realized the garden is everywhere, not just in particular places. But our somewhat biased mind says, the rose garden, the best rose garden is in Portland, Oregon. This is a metaphor. The rose is a literal thing and a metaphor simultaneously. The rose garden is everywhere for the eyes that are unclouded by longing, as the Tao. The truth awaits eyes unclouded by longing. So thank goodness. It's a tremendous thing in this world that we share, that there are guides, there are teachers, there are spiritual friends. Hopefully, we're spiritual friends. And in case you don't feel like you have any spiritual friends, you might have one by the end of this event, or a whole bunch of them. My spiritual friends are my best friends. And some of them I don't get to see very often at all because they're all over the earth. A lot of them don't live physically nearby. It's about quality of contact, not quantity. And when I say contact, I'm not talking necessarily about physical proximity contact. Because through this power, this field, of awareness, we can begin to see that physical proximity is not required for intimacy. So the teachers or the guides, they can tell us about what they've realized, and they can point, and they can offer instructions and suggestions and encouragement and inspiration, and that's wonderful. In some cases, they even can give direct transmissions of the Buddha nature, the Buddha mind. But if they give direct transmission, it's still going to require ripeness to get it. We need to understand that there were people in the Buddhist time. Here's the seed of enlightenment manifesting, yeah, the pristine, unalloyed, unconditioned reality. 45 years on the planet, and there are people walking away, there are people getting angry, and there are even people trying to kill them. So that ripeness, we're seeing what we can do about that. Many people come on events like this. It's called an insight meditation retreat. And they say, I sat for 4 days, I sat for 5 days, I sat for 7 days, I sat for 2 weeks, I sat for 1 month. I've been sitting for years, and I haven't had one insight. And you might be thinking that sometimes. I haven't had any insight. I had a lot of thoughts, a lot of sensations, decent food, little sleep, back and forth, few dreams. Listen to that guy, Paul. Sometimes I could hear him, sometimes I couldn't. Sometimes I didn't want to hear him. Sometimes I liked hearing him. I haven't had one insight, though. This is not working. I must admit I have relaxed. It was when I did that lying down pose at the end of the day, before I fell asleep, I relaxed. Oh, but those insights, where are they? Are they just around the corner? Maybe I'm having them, but I'm not seeing them. Well, then that doesn't count. You got to actually experience it directly, don't you? You can't just think you had an insight. Can you? One person I like a lot comes around some of these things, and he says, for me, I sit. If I have an insight, it's luck. So I've been, you know, interacting with him. I'm saying, look, I think it's a little bit more than luck. Let's see if we can fine-tune that, you see? These teachings, these instructions, these suggestions, these invitations. Are you comprehending them intellectually? Oh, yes, yes, I'm not comprehending them intellectually. Are they sinking in? Are you feeling them trickle down? Are we getting a percolation down in there at all? Yeah. You know, and it's as I'm listening, it's just a little, getting a little fuzzy for me as I'm listening. It's a little waffly. It's a little like, yeah, and it's sort of drifting to, is this really happening? Or are you kind of saying it might be happening, or are you just thinking about it? So we have some more exploration to do, because there's a process going on there of discerning, right, for himself what's true. What's true? Isn't that what this is about? Discerning for ourselves what's true. And so we need to, and we have, start with something simple. A body sitting on a cushion, bench, chair. A body breathing air. Can we tune into that reality? Can we get in touch with what's going on there without too much overlay of our busy, at times distracted, preoccupied, overactive brain? And that's no small thing, is it, to drop down? That's no small thing to really drop down. That's no small thing to come out into the silence. There's a lot of people who would not want to have one afternoon of the silence that we've been sharing now for, what, 3 days almost? Not one afternoon. It's too quiet. It's going to be up to us to see for ourselves what works and what doesn't. And there's a lot of what doesn't. There's a lot of weeding through that needs to take place for many of us so that we can begin to see the truth for ourselves. That's a lot about what the practice is. How about that? There's an insight. I'm weeding through what's not working, hopefully. If it's truly up to us to to see for ourselves. If nobody can do this for us, or as some folks say, nobody else can save you, you're going to have to save yourself. You're going to have to see for yourself what's true. You're going to have to see for yourself what works. You're going to have to take it upon yourself. You're going to have to assume that fundamental responsibility. Even if you believe that another person's presence, another person, without you even necessarily being ripe, can awaken you, you're going to have to still get to that person, and you're going to have to get positioned in such a way so that that might happen. And I want to put that word might there, big time. This recognition, or insight, if I dare use that term, this insight that we're going to need to do it for ourselves, for some of us, is wonderfully relieving because we stop messing around with other things. We stop beating around the bush. We really take it seriously, sincerely, upon ourselves. This is going to be up to me here. If there's conflict, if there's disturbance, if there's unease, if there's fear, if there's angst, if there's confusion in my mind-body process, it's up to me to find the way out. For some of us, this is a big relief. But for others of us, this can be quite disturbing, quite an issue. It's relieving when we have enough trust or faith to simply rest into the receptivity and see what resonates spontaneously. The natural unfoldment of some gradual insight can take place, and we simply stay alert and sensitive to that. We just see what we can do to open ourselves up, and we just see what comes up. We just see what comes in. It seems like, in a way, there's nothing to do there in that case except just stay receptive. And yet, we might find we need to get around some definitive expressions because we haven't quite been able to see the Buddha nature in the leaf coming up from the concrete, nor in the movement of the tree leaves, nor in the blue sky, as pretty as it is. It's still a blue sky in my mind. And so we need some definitive, explicit expressions where the teachings are being offered as directly as possible, and then we need to let them work. In that case, you kind of see if you can just kind of get out of the way and let the transformation happen. Sounds kind of easy, but it's not. It's rather simple, but not necessarily easy. What's exciting at times is when something new comes. When your child and something new appears in your life, particularly if you like that, you're immediately happy, maybe even overjoyed. I have a little note. It's from when my son was like 6, and he's quite a bit older chronologically now, and I stuck it on the edge of my bookcase. And he's written, and he didn't quite get all the words right. He left off letters. It said, "Mommy, Daddy, and Alana," that's his sister. "After dinner," he leaves off one of the ends, "put on blindfolds and come in to living room for surprise." And I can't quite remember what that initially triggered in me, but I stuck it there, and it's been sitting in the same spot for 13 years. I look at it again and again from time to time just to see what it evokes. Comes in handy when you need a little something in a Dharma talk. Something surprises us. Something refreshes us. Even a new piece of music sometimes comes in. Somebody says, "Have you heard this before?" Maybe it doesn't even strike a chord at first time, and maybe there's a little interest to play it again for some reason. You play it again, all of a sudden it strikes a chord, and there's something in there. Didn't even get it the first time, and there it is. Then you play it a third time, and you realize, whoa, this is going someplace. This is going someplace. This is getting my attention. I'm liking this. And this can happen around all kinds of different things. When what's surprising us, what's refreshing us, what's alerting us, what's awakening us, is a sense of freedom. A bigger, broader, maybe more sublime, less excited, I might add, less excited happiness, maybe even a sense of contentment and fulfillment, maybe a sense of peace. When that's arising, it's magical in a way, mysterious how it happens, but as when that's arising, it seems to resonate differently than somebody telling you about how to make a better apple pie. As wonderful as that is, if you like apple pies, and I like apple pies. And when the teachings are really working in the system, they are coming through the apple pie too. But hold off on that for a second. That's like dessert. The explicit expression of the teachings that definitely stimulate the possibility that freedom, fulfillment, definitive reduction of conflict is your birthright. That says something important to us. And it's not to be missed. Hopefully, or overlooked. Now, it's nice to kind of go to the other side of the same hand, or the other hand, if you like that image better, recognizing that only your own direct experience is really going to do this, is really going to be it, is really going to be, may I say, the teacher. The only true thing that's going to be the guide and light of the journey. No one can do it for you. No one else can be you. And in fact, you are waking up alone. No one else can die for you. And even if someone, maybe the one you would really want to be there, is sitting by your side at death, you will go through death alone. Again, for some, it's quite relieving. Of course, that's the way it is. That's the design, of course. For others, it's like, oh no. No, 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 no. I don't like the sound of that. It can even be shocking. You don't have to be getting close to death for the deep sense of aloneness to be shocking. Many people avoid this. You know how they avoid it? By confusing aloneness with loneliness. Loneliness. I need something. I'm missing something. I need somebody. I need more than somebody. I've had somebody for a while. I'm still lonely. I actually was doing better alone. Now that I'm with you, I'm feeling more lonely. This isn't working very well. You are supposed to relieve me of my loneliness, and I'm feeling more alone in your presence than I ever felt by myself. Funny stuff. Let me read Hafiz. I love Hafiz. I loved Rumi for many years, and then I found Hafiz and decided that I loved him more. He's all over the place. That's partly why I like him. So this one here popped up. It's called For 3 Days. I figured it'd be fitting since we've been here about 3 days. Here's how he says it. Not many teachers in this world can give you as much enlightenment in 1 year as sitting all alone for 3 days in your closet would do. That means not leaving. Better get a friend to help with a few sandwiches and a chamber pot. And no reading in there or writing poems. That would be cheating. Aim high for a 360-degree detox. This sitting alone, though, is not recommended if you are normally sedated or have ever been under a doctor's surveillance for your brain. Dear one, don't let Hafiz fool you. A ruby is buried in here. Few. What's that? Hafiz.
Can you spell it?
H-A-F-I-Z. We'll get another one from him later. He sparks a little surprise and interest, huh? What's that guy's name? So, we can try to avoid being truly alone by staying busy, distracted, and being surrounded by others as much as possible until we get sick of it. And we will inevitably get sick of it. If you get sick of being alone, you've not yet discerned the difference between alone and lonely. And one of the reasons why that's true is that this amazing, mysterious aloneness is in fact only one letter shy in spelling from all one. Aloneness is a Dharma gate. It is a portal into true togetherness. And if we don't get steady and even, you could say, in love with aloneness, we're never going to be truly happy in relationship with others. Now, when I use the words, all one, I don't mean some kind of syrupy closeness or conceptual notion that we're all connected and one, when we might agree with each other, care about the same things, or feel like we are friends. I'm talking about unicity or oneness emerging because there's a reduction and eventual elimination of psychological and emotional conflict. And what this means is that you can always do a litmus test. You can always check where the awakening is at for you by seeing if there's any arguments with your life. Let's call that yourself. Differentiated into arguments with others. An argument with God, if you have one. And any arguments with death. Want to see where the awakening's at? Run those litmus tests. If there are any arguments, there's work to do. There's learning or unlearning. There's insights that can come. There's care to the garden of your life that's being called for. You don't have to be intellectually intelligent to see that. You just need to be honest and recognize that if there's an argument, what's your part? What's your part? This really great saint named the Sargadatta Maharaj, people would always be talking about their pain and their problems and stuff. And he once just said to a group, he said, "You people are all confused. You keep talking about what you don't want to have happen. You keep talking about what you do want to have happen. Why don't you just reverse it? Want what you have and not want what you don't have. You've got it reversed. You don't want what you have, and you want what you don't have. Flip it." And in that moment, what's the insight? I'm my own problem. I'm my own problem. Even if I'm convinced that somebody else is my problem, I am with them because of my problem. Not their problem. So we get this understanding at times in our mind, whether we're meditating or not. We get this understanding at times in our mind, and we might have a sense of how things are, how our life is, you know, where we come from, what we've been through, what even the future might hold. We might go into that a little bit, how we're doing in the moment, and we feel like we've got some understanding. Our world feels a bit organized. Emotionally it feels organized, or mentally it feels organized. Body might feel relatively organized. And in these moments, psychological, emotional conflict may be diminished, may even feel like it's completely gone. And yet, it's very temporary in many cases, and superficial, actually. The reason why insights are important, not just because they lead to realization, but insights are important because when insight arises, it momentarily stops the conceptual mind. The conceptual mind dissolves momentarily. And there's a deeper sense of release from conflict and stress, even if it's just a flash, just a second. And the fragrance or the echo or ripple effect of that insight is so fascinating. So you might say, "Well, I still haven't had an insight in the retreat." And all of a sudden you're driving your car home. And you have one of the major insights that almost everybody has after one of these. I am going slower than the rest of the cars. I am annoying people. And then it gets a little richer sometimes. I am in danger. I am having my own version of the non-gender bias form of PMS, post-meditative syndrome. Thank goodness we're not doing deep concentration practice. Last time I did that, right? Deep concentration practice. So I get out of the retreat. I mentioned this in a small group meeting. I'll try to embellish it, keep it interesting. And I go in and I'm going to get something. Not sure what. There's a store. It's in front of me. And like my dear mother-in-law, when I would say, What do you plan on getting at the mall? I love it. I'll figure it out when I get there. So I walk into the 7-Eleven or whatever it was, and the Buddha field appears. And now you have to make a decision. And if you've tranquilized your brain enough with concentration and insight and food like this and silence and people like you, what happens is it's impossible to make a decision. Because you're just so in your senses, and it's so nice to just see the colors and the plastic, and then pretty soon there's a word on there. And it says something like on the Fiji water bottle, it says, together. The store closes and you're still there. For those of you who've been to Australia, you know this better than myself. But some of the Aboriginals, when they've been displaced, shall I be more direct and say genocided, will go to a spot where there is a store, and they'll sit in that store on the spot, because the store is irrelevant to them, actually. They're sitting on a particular spot. And us white folk, who understand something of what's happening, don't interfere with that. It's a kind of connectedness, a kind of knowing that a lot of us don't even dream is possible. The insights, as hard-earned as they might seem, will come if you're committed to living a contemplative life. And you can live a contemplative life and be completely involved and committed and responsible to a business, to a family, as long as it doesn't take up too much of you. If it takes up too much of you, there's none of you left over for the practice, for the contemplation. You might have a minute here or there to just reflect on what you're doing, because you've been so busy doing, there's not much time to even reflect on it. And maybe most of us in this room have already made that shift. We've committed and we've realized the contemplative life is absolutely necessary for awakening and for a world, if that's of interest to you, that's more peaceful while you're in it. You can't make them come. It'd be kind of nice if we could, you know? It'd be kind of nice if you could just sit down and say, okay, give me the full insight. You know why that won't happen? Because it's not the design. And secondly, you couldn't take it. The reason why this stuff happens gradually, it seems, is because we can't take the openness. We can't take the unfiltered vulnerability. It's too much. We would contract back from it. Opening up is like the filters coming off. And people say, well, I thought it was about bliss. Well, it is, but not just about bliss. It's about feeling everything without filtration in the way. The difference is the sense of the I or me, who it's happening to, softens, and it's just open, flowing, feeling. And what's painful is even more painful, and what's pleasurable is even more pleasurable, and what's neutral is even more neutral, because there's nothing in the way. Makes sense. Now, there's understanding that's mental or conceptual, intellectual. There's insights that lead to realization, and then there's liberation. And the reason why it's important to hear about liberation is because it's critical to recognize that it's possible. Liberation is when realizations have completed their work. Liberation is the permanent end of all conflict and all traces of strife, fear, grasping, and confusion. Realizations can touch. Liberation. But liberation is not truly open until the sense or the idea of someone who's realizing things is gone for good. Everybody in this room is having tastes or touches, even if they're very, very, very short-lived, of not being somebody. They are missed oftentimes because they're subtle, and the one who's busy being somebody tries to take up all the airspace. But they're in there, and what we're doing here in part is being offered an opportunity to look, and like I said last night in the talk, to look in a different direction. Let's be clear, it's not easy to recognize awareness, to actually see awareness. It's very simple, but it's very, very different for most of us. We're so involved in looking at the content, looking at the experiences, sorting out the experiences, having the better experience, different experience. We're just very, very busy moving the furniture around. Mm-hmm. And we think if we get the furniture moved around just right, then we're going to sit back and we're going to really enjoy the room. I'm saying look at the room now. Don't get lost in the furniture. And then once you see the room, see what it is that sees the room. Oneness, true unicity, cannot emerge truly unless the idea of someone falls away. This is oneness. This is wholeness. The only thing that seems to be in disagreement with that is me. Now you can conceptually go, oh yeah, we're all one, I can kind of feel that. Yeah, it's kind of warm, there's a little less boundary on that side of my body while I was sitting. I kind of feel that. And then with that sound, when he said, is the sound inside or outside? And then he said, or both? It really seems to be both. Okay, so that boundary's softening, that seems like oneness there. Yeah. And so we're kind of sensing something, and then we might be thinking about it. Oneness or unicity shows up every single night in deep sleep, and we miss it. And it's wonderful, and it's nourishing, and it's refreshing, and the I or me wakes up in the morning with the first thought, and if you watch in the morning, maybe tomorrow, you will see the first thought, and if you look at that space prior to the first thought, you'll realize there was nothing there, there was nothing there, and it was totally peaceful. This can be seen. It's not necessarily easy to see, but some people see it. I have a fellow that used to come on these retreats. He said, I can observe the deep sleep state fully. And he described it to me in detail. It was authentic. Now, he'd been trying to have that experience, so that did probably assist. Fully conscious in the deep sleep state. You know why there's awareness in the deep sleep state? Because there's a memory trace of the effect of the deep sleep state when the body-mind wakes up. And there's that feeling of, ooh, that was really nice to be nobody. Thank you. That's the design. When there's a release from being someone who realizes things, even just a little, then the insights start to come much more readily. You know why? Because the somebody sitting around here who's trying to have insights is in the way. It's just like people who lie down and they've got some trouble there falling asleep and they're trying to fall asleep. You want to know how to guarantee you won't fall asleep? Try to fall asleep. And then we work at it and you try this and pretty soon you're, you know, doing this and doing that, and pretty soon if you're not careful you're taking medications. You're the character that Hafiz was talking about that doesn't, you know, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't get to be alone, that's it. What you can begin to see right away here is that everything, including the sense of the I or me that arises and passes, everything here is being itself. The room is being itself. Furniture is being itself. These bodies are being themselves. The sounds are being themselves. I had a wonderful interaction with the cook before dinner because I was committed suddenly, don't ask me why, I was committed suddenly to removing the squeak in that door. It was a compelling insight that it needed to be done. And maybe it was a realization, or maybe it was a liberation, I don't know what, but suddenly I was compelled, and so I found her, and she was in motion, let me tell you, she was in motion in there. Was kind of like this swirling dervish type cook. And she's coming at me, and I'm thinking, maybe I should go back and sit. What can I do? And she gets right up there. What can I do for you? And I said, well, we have this little thing going on with incense upstairs, and is anybody on the staff, you know, smoking or burning incense upstairs? Oh, no, it's just you folks. You're the director, right? Aren't you? You're the director of your program, aren't you? So you should just tell them not to do that. Because one of you guys, gals, is doing that. I said, okay, I got it. Thanks. Can we move on to number two? Do you have any WD-40 for the door? She says, no. And then she's swirling again. She says, let me get my keys. And she goes and gets her keys and takes me to the service room over here with the tools, and we find some oil. Which doesn't work. So then I get innovative because I'm still committed, thinking that I should be eating dinner and preparing for the talk. Because I want this talk to be perfect. But now I'm conflicted because I've got this door to fix. And you can't let go, you know, if you're Paul Lynn, once you decide to do something. So I can't get the oil to work and it's on my hand and this is getting worse and I'm squeaking the door and thinking, they're all hearing me. I wonder what they're thinking. I just keep squeaking the door trying to... So I say, just yank on the thing and see if that'll reduce it. Maybe it'll just be one of these adjustments you can do that doesn't work. So then I get even further innovative. I get rid of the oil, figure, okay, I'm going to give up. And then I look around in there and I say, oh, what's that stuff? I wonder if I should just squirt it on there or should read the label first. So I read the label and it's some kind of cleaner or something. So I squirt it on there and the squeak goes away. Third noble truth, cessation of the need to fix the door. I'm telling you, folks, the insights are right there. All you got to do is get a little conflicted, get tied up between two different commitments, and then stay with it. And the inside of the third noble truth is yours. Boom. So really, everything is being itself, and everything actually being itself free from conflict and taint. Everything is being itself unfettered. And it's just the beliefs and opinions in the mind that say other than that. It's the beliefs and the opinions in the mind that say other than that. Belief in conditioning and conflict is what gives it its force and power. What we're exploring is how the energy of belief in conflict can begin to drain or transform out of those tendencies, those pockets, those habits of how we view what's going on. And if we're not careful there, we start projecting an idea, a fantasy land of what it's going to be like when we're not carrying these beliefs and opinions around that bring conflict. What we're missing sometimes is that the light of awareness is deconditioning those conditioned beliefs and opinions. And this is the part that people don't want to admit until they're really ready to admit it. That this frictional, what we talked about, is sort of like the burning up of ignorance, is so healthy, it is so good for you, for life, because if it doesn't get transformed and burned up, then what is it going to do? It's going to find another way to the surface at one time or the other and find its way into the stream of your thoughts, your feelings, and your behavior. And for me, at least, it was a riveting revelation to recognize this, to see that there was actually this possibility of transforming the deepest things that conflicted my sense of life. Now, it gets so much almost like tantric here sometimes that people will go so far on that angle that I'm talking about that they'll sit and they'll just be in a very clear, loving space. Bring it on. Bring it on, whatever it is. They just say, come right into it. Now, that can get a little extreme too, right? You take that a little bit too far. Like the guy who said, well, you know, if sitting cross-legged is good, well, then maybe this is better. And then he said, and he wasn't ready for this. And then he said, and maybe this is even better. And then we went for walking meditation, and he had a cramp from sitting full lotus, and he fell down and sprained his ankle. It was the only injury that I've ever experienced on retreat in all the years. And he did it to himself. Because he had an idea that, you know, I'm going to push it. See, we never really know what's going to be there for us when the conflict and strife falls away. It's just an imagination. And what's fascinating is the imagination is so often wrong. This is not about imagining what's going to happen as freedom dawns. This is about realizing that the truth is pulling you. Again, the Tao, truth awaits eyes unclouded by longing. When this contraction, and it is a contraction, of trying to get somewhere or get something, and the efforts on the other side of the same hand or other hand to avoid something, when this contracted habitual tendency is realized as futile in terms of bringing about anything truly fulfilling and satisfactory, then it can fall away, or at least start to fall away. And what remains, a little or a lot, is the truth of your being resting as itself. And again, everyone in this room has been experiencing the truth of their being resting as itself, but that doesn't mean it's being recognized. Just like there's a ton of children on the planet right now who are shining the Buddha nature, the original nature, and they don't see it. Maybe some others do if they're not too involved in their thinking about things and they recognize that they're looking at themselves. You see, those children, in most cases, don't recognize the Buddha nature. Isn't that interesting? And then they go through a cycle, a long samsaric cycle, that's us, of feeling like we've fallen from grace, of feeling like we've now gotten confused, lost, conditioned. And what would you say that's all about? Well, I'll take a guess at it. That's about saying you need to take the curriculum, as Ram Dass said, you need to take your curriculum while you're here and get the lessons so that you can recognize what you actually always already are, because it's obscured until it isn't. And that's literally how it works. We go through the mill of life, the conditioned mill, to wake up, to see that we've always been that child of wonder, regardless of our age chronologically or our psychological, emotional condition, our gender, whether our body has diseases or not, or how long the body's going to live. The futility, and seeing the futility of the seeking and grasping mind that is fascinated, and it is fascinated, it's an important word, the grasping and seeking mind is fascinated with conflict. It's in fact addicted to conflict and complexity. Seeing this, again, just for a second, opens the possibility that these mechanisms are seen to be failing. That's so important. It is unsettling, and it can be quite devastating if we've really invested in this way of living our life. We see that it's failing. And that failure, that very failure, opens up the space for the dissolution of that pattern. Seeking, grasping, or resisting, and all of the energy that goes into that, can fall away. And that's what opens the truth. As Krishnamurti said, it's the truth itself that sets you free, not your efforts to be free. Wholeness, or all oneness, or as I like to use the term, unicity, doesn't come about through something gained, but rather through something lost. Realization is about loss, not gain. And the sense of a personal will, which many people have inside, a personal will, is actually the base energy that separates us from all of life. And thus the teaching, the ancient teaching that's articulated in many different traditions. The one I like the most, though, is not my will, but thine. And the thine means the Dharma, the truth of the way things are, the Tao, the nature of things, the Buddha nature. That's the thine. The natural being, which is sitting here, the natural being that we are, is utterly ordinary and gentle in its constancy. It requires no effort, demands, has no standards to uphold, no opinions or views, takes no sides and asks for nothing. Therefore, it allows and gives everything. That natural being is sitting in this room right now. Within that natural being, all there is what's happening. Hearing these sounds, these words, listening, breathing, thinking, perceiving, blood coursing through the body, sensations, bums sitting on chairs and cushions, This is wholeness. Being aliveness as what is happening. In actuality, it's the complete absence of someone being present. It's presence free from identification. It's presence unidentified as someone who's present. And it is in all these things I'm mentioning. Presence that is free from identification is the true nature of the heart. As the sentient core that perceives love and wholeness, this is the part of the body that perceives wholeness. And the cognitive and gut centers need to be drawn into this through the experience of insight. The cognitive center and the gut center, bit by bit, drawn into the heart through the power of insights. You feel the pull at times in the meditation to just be up here, 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 to be up here, be up here, come out of here, be up here. Feel the pull at times when this gets going, when this emotional center really gets going in the meditation. One can't even think when there's enough emotion moving in the gut. Can't even think about it, especially if it's fear or if it's anger. It really stirs down there. Those energies, bit by bit, they settle. It's as if this one settles up, this one settles down. And right in here starts to wake up. And this heart that we are is the childlike awe. It is the innocence ever open to discovery. It is that which is seen through the eyes when the eyes are not too busy, tied up in looking for things, thinking about things, trying to get things. When this and this align, you can look in people's eyes and you can literally see their heart. And when two beings look at one another and the heart is connected up through the eyes, then those two hearts meet. And the insight there, very simply said, is both beings realize they're looking at themselves. There's not two, there's just one. This happens all the time when people say, oh, I like you. Oh, you're interesting. Oh, you have pretty eyes. I have two different color eyes. Iridologists love me. They walk up to me and they go, wow. How's your colon? I say, pretty good today. How's yours? Well, you have this large brown thing there that looks like a colon spot in your iris. Oh, thank you. There's oneness hiding inside that. You know, oneness hiding inside that. So I was going to get my birth brother back in briefly just to round out the loose cannon story from the other night. He drops in and out of my life periodically, and at times he completely drops out, and at times, you know, doesn't respond, which sometimes is hard for me. I wish it wasn't like that, but it happens that way for different reasons, and then sometimes we're really close. So lately we've been getting close again, and so he decides to just come out with something, and he, again, the loose cannon quality, and he just gets on the phone with me and he says, I got to tell you something. I said, what's that? He said, remember when we were little? I said, yeah. He said, you unconditionally loved me. You loved me so much. You unconditionally loved me for 12 years. Do you remember this? Mm-hmm. He just like pops it out. And I was like, you know, I felt emotional. Like I started to feel, whoa, you know, that I know you're full of surprises and you are a loose cannon, but I never thought that was coming. And he just pops it right out. And I was like, you know, I was just a little back. I was like surprised and a little defended. And I said, yeah, it was interesting. He said, you're not hearing me. And he did it again. He went right in. He was like a Zen master. He just went, you loved me more than any other person. Your love was unconditional. And then he threw the curveball. I love this one. What happened to you? What happened to you? So the defense came in again. I said, well, it really wasn't just me. It was you, too. He goes, yeah, I know I've been disappointing, but I'm asking you a question. What happened to you?
I wiped
up. So we'll see if we can keep it going, you know, because I said, well, it's still here. You know, it's still here. It's still here. You know, the unconditional is still here. So, I can remember when you and I were coming home from school and we were getting attacked by these boys in the snowball fight, and they had ice balls and they had them ready for us and they were pounding us. And then when they finished that ordeal, they decided to require, because there's like 10 of them and 4 of us, require that you, my dear brother, fight one of them. And so my brother, and I knew that what he just chose to do there was the stupidest thing he could have done. He chose the toughest kid. He chose the toughest kid. And then they went into a fist fight, and they're all bloody. And I'm a mess on the sideline, crying. Neighbor boys holding me. We get out of it. I said, I remember that. He said, yeah, but I got a few good punches in, didn't I? I said, yeah, but you lost. Seeing that the original unconditioned nature is an unaltered, unfabricated flow that is unified, that the way things really are, and that includes your sense of a self that comes and goes, must include, if unification is total, it must include that. It's simpler than any of your beliefs have ever even suggested to you it might be. And this is not some fairy tale, some fairy land that's far off where only the really lucky, the Buddhas, those who are born in families where the parents are meditating and they bring you right into that space. Steve and I know a teacher who came into that space. His father was a deep master of meditation. Very renowned master, and the sons, there was a number of them, came in into this kind of environment. It's not just for those lucky ones. This is about realizing that the childlike Buddha nature, the childlike wonder, has been trampled, stomped, exiled into ignorance through everything from subtle persuasion to violent aggression. But here's the tremendous, grand, great news. This is about realizing that it can never be harmed. That original childlike wonder can never be harmed, even as the body-mind gets shunned, shamed, criticized, beat up. This is about realizing that it is truly possible for there to be a release of the fearful contraction that feeds the ignorant opinions and views parading as this whole psychology of grasping and pushing away and basically having a war all to our own in our minds. Beginning to see that those very deep energies, the energy of hate, you go deep enough in the practice, you see that your mind is fully capable of hating. It's even fully capable of engaging in thoughts and ideas of killing other human beings. I couldn't believe that for myself until it happened to me. Not that I killed a person, thank goodness, but I fully wanted to, and I couldn't believe it. It totally overcame me. When the teacher Stephen Levine, I'm not sure whether he's doing much these days, Stephen Andrea Levine, great poet, great meditation teacher, when he used to sit at the Insight Meditation Society up in Barre, Massachusetts, a place that I spent a lot of time back in the 80s and 90s, he'd have these full-on, like I don't know whether they were hallucinations or, you know, he described these things with his meditation where he felt like he was back in Nazi Germany. And he was moving from one sort of side of the coin to the other, from the victims to the perpetrator and back and forth. And I was like, man, I'm just feeling my breath. Talk about open. You either got a great imagination or, man, you're connected. You begin to see that all of it is just a fantastic, profound, ever-changing movement of energy, regardless of how we name it and particularize it and describe it. It's this fantastic unfolding energy. And there's nothing solid or fixed about it. And we begin to see that this well-intended, and it is, it's a well-intended protective shell, blindly, yes, identified with the role of guarding the innocent, immaculate, pearl beyond price, original nature of what we are, can retire. And as this contraction falls away, when it's seen, and it needs to be seen in order to fall away, that's what some people call the hard work. To stay with the actuality of what's happening, so that that protective shell, that defensive protective shell, can actually be seen, can be revealed. And that its task can complete itself. And then we don't have, at least in that moment, anything to prove or disprove. We don't have any more argument with life, and we may not have any more argument with death. And then there's resting as you are. And everything is what it is. And what is happening is simple being. The mind has a hard time with non-duality because the mind is busy maintaining duality. Here is one of the simplest descriptions of non-duality I think I've ever heard. It comes from this great sage and saint, Ramana Maharshi. He had a way of being very direct, not necessarily all that poetic, but just very, very direct and clear. See how this works for you. We see only the script, not the paper on which the script is written. The paper is there, whether the script is on it or not. To those who look upon the script as real, you have to say that it is unreal, an illusion, since it rests upon the paper. The wise person looks upon both paper and script as one. So he's saying, just like I was saying last night, there's the screen, and then there's the movie on the screen. Or go the other way. There's the experiences unfolding, and there's the awareness that sees. The awareness that sees and the experiences unfolding on the screen are one. No separation. In a way, it's as simple as thinking that your fingers are apart and then they're touching. And that's life. Every single aspect of it is touching every other aspect of it. And when that's seen, the other, the sense of other drops. And it's just what is. And there's no separation. So you could say it this way. What we are is this energy of being, unshaped by any concept or identification of any kind, fundamentally. And of course, because our brain really just has to stay in it as often as it needs to until it can rest, it says, ooh, I'm the energy. And then it just adds that little thought in there, I'm the energy. As soon as it says, I'm the energy, it just extracts that segment of energy that it's perceiving out of the vastness of energy, and now there's separation again. Its single thought will do it. When there is no idea that I am this energy, I'm not even the energy that sees. I'm not awareness even. I'm not awareness even. Because that's a very popular one to go for. I am the awareness. When that falls away, then all there is being. All there is the nature of life as it is. So one more from Hafiz. He got a nice response from many of you. My partner, wife, had the good fortune to meet the man who translated this. She met him in India. She said he was pretty wild. Hafiz-like, I guess. So this one is called, We Have Not Come to Take Prisoners. We have not come here to take prisoners, but to surrender ever more deeply to freedom and joy. We have not come into this exquisite world to hold ourselves hostage from love. Run, my dear, from anything that may not strengthen your precious budding wings. Run like hell, my dear, from anyone likely to put a sharp knife into the sacred, tender vision of your beautiful heart. We have a duty to befriend those aspects of obedience that stand outside of our house and shout to our reason, oh please, come out and play. For we have not come here to take prisoners or to confide our wondrous spirits, but to experience ever and ever more deeply our divine courage, freedom, and light. We've not come here to take prisoners. Can we sit for a minute?